Well, as you know, and some of you experienced, we went on the snow trip last weekend. So we were driving back from the snow trip, and there was a lull in the conversation in the car, so I said, let's talk about something controversial. So Kenneth Jenkins, Dr. Jenkins, the esteemed Mr. Jenkins, said, Christians have a moral obligation not to spend so much money on going on ski trips.
Damn.
Yeah.
Wasn't he there with
you? Yeah, exactly. So we talked about something else. It was too much for us. But it was a good question. And it's the question that is, in a sense, at the heart of the things we're looking at tonight. How ought Christians to spend money? It's possible. Should we not have gone up to Tahoe and spent money on skiing and food and gas? Is that a waste of the resources God has given us? Or is that an appropriate use of funds? That's a good question. And it's not a question we should pass over lightly. It's not a question we should just ignore. But we should wrestle with it. And this passage tonight invites us to wrestle with it. Because we're looking at Amos 6, and actually, tonight's a good night to have some Bibles. So, might be one hands about.
Sure.
In the passage tonight, Amos really criticizes the extravagant living of the nation of Israel. So it's Amos 6, I think it's page 768. I think my Bible has the same page numbers as that one. You can let me know if I'm wrong. So Amos is criticizing the nation of Israel here for living extravagantly. And it's a tough question for us to address because we live in arguably the richest part of the world. We have, now granted it costs a lot to live here, but we have a lot of resources by virtue of living here. And so we have to ask the question, what of what Amos says is applicable to us? Do we live too extravagantly? There's a team from PBC that just returned from India, and they visited these partners that we work with in India, and Scott Grant was telling me about this couple that I know both of them, and they recently got married, and they're both on OM staff, and they're living in this compound where they literally, it's one big room, it's about the size of this room actually, and everybody has basically cubicle rooms. It's not even like walls. So it's married couples living there because that's all they can afford. They basically get paid each about $75 a month. So they're living on the equivalent of about $150 a month. And they just live super simply. They eat at the OM compound, at the mission compound. They rarely do anything that costs any money. And it's challenging. You know, we spent thousands of dollars just to get there. And you encounter people that live such a different lifestyle. And it forces you to ask the question, as it should, well, is this right? How do you make sense of all this? So I think Amos actually helps. Because when we see what Amos criticizes and how he criticizes the nation of Israel, it helps us to think about our own life. It helps us to find parallels. And it helps us to identify what it is that's really the root issue that Amos wants to deal with. And Amos, the chapter we're looking at really breaks down into two sections. First is really the criticism of the way they're living. It's Amos discussing their prosperity, telling them what they're doing wrong as they experience life in plenty among all the resources they have. And then Amos tells what God is going to do as a judgment to them. And we hear their response. And their response is how they're responding to the pain, the judgment that God is going to bring them. And so these two sections are kind of two sides of a coin. On one hand, it's how do people respond when they have plenty? On the other hand, it's how do people respond when they're in pain? And what we're going to see as we look at those two sides is really that they're related, that they are at root connected to one core attitude, and it has to do with how we view God, how we understand God, and how we understand what He does and what He gives us in our lives. So we're going to start by looking at Amos 6, 1 to 7. Does anybody feel like reading that for us? Amos 6, 1 to 7, now that I got you all Bibles? You want to read, Howard? Great.
Sure.
Okay, verse 1. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion, and to those who feel secure in the mountain of Samaria, the notable men of the first nations to whom the house of Israel comes. Pass over to Calneh and see from there, go to Hamath the Great, and then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are you better than these kingdoms, or is their territory greater than your territory? O who put far away the day of disaster and bring near the sea of violence? Or who put far away? What are those who lie on beds of ivory and stretch themselves on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and, like David, invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine in bowls and who anoint themselves with the finest oils but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph? Therefore they shall be the first of those who go into exile, and the revelry of those who stretch themselves shall pass away.
Great, thanks. So Amos, this is an oracle of woe. This is a condemnation against certain people for certain reasons. And so to get our minds around this, I want us to really think about who Amos is criticizing. That's essentially the first several verses. And then why he's criticizing them. So I'm going to record, and you guys are going to answer. So who is Amos criticizing? What types of people? This is where you talk.
Loungers.
Okay, mostly this is from verses 1 to 3. People in Zion, okay?
And Samaria.
Right, so Zion and Samaria, those were the capitals of the city. Oh, the two capitals of the northern and southern kingdoms. So what kind of people live in capitals?
City folk.
Wealthy people. Yeah, upper class, nobility, people of power, right? What else? How else are they described?
They eat baby animals.
Okay, that's going to be over here on the Y. Eat baby animals. How else are the people described?
At ease, so here's a bit.
At ease, yeah. People that are at ease and feel secure.
Notable.
What else? That's pretty good. People to whom the house of Israel comes. So this is people who would be receiving as guests the royalty, right? So these are powerful people. Powerful, wealthy, famous, right? That kind of goes along with notable. So these are people that have a lot of spare time. They're the wealthy, they're the upper class. They are at ease. Why would you be at ease in a culture like that, an ancient culture? What gives you security?
Luxuries.
Yeah, luxuries, servants, money. Most people live off the land. It's an agricultural environment. And so mostly you can eat if you grow it, right? But you're secure if you have stockpiles, if you have saved up money, if you have people to do your work for you. Notable people are the people that are known. They're doing interesting things. They're from good families. They have power. Wealthy people, famous people. So this is describing a class of people. What's that? Is there anything else?
No, that's fine.
Yeah. So this is describing a class of people that Amos is criticizing. It's an upper class. It's a rich class. It's a recreation-filled class. And it's fair to ask then, do we fit these categories in general? Right? So where do we live? That's not a hard question. Silicon Valley, right. That's an important place. Are we relatively secure, right? We're not worried that if our crops don't grow, we're not going to eat. I mean, there's a terrible drought. If this were ancient Israel, we would be terrified that we wouldn't be able to live, right? We're just upset we can't ski, right? Notable, I mean, if you canvas the companies and the organizations that are worked for in this room, they're in the news everywhere, right? We work among the most well-known academic institutions and companies and medical facilities in the world. We have money unlike anywhere else in the world. We have power to do things, to travel, to live our lives the way we want to. So, basically, this is us, right? We fit these categories. Okay, so now let's figure out, what is Amos criticizing? Why is he criticizing them? What are the activities that they do? We have eat baby animals, calves and little lambs, right? What else?
Sing idol songs.
They sing idol songs, yeah.
Drink wine in bowls.
Wine in bowls, yeah. What does that mean? Why? What is that significant?
Bowls are pretty big.
Bowls are really big, yeah. I drink wine in cups, right? Glasses. People have bowls of wine they're drinking, so it's excessive, it's volume. What else?
Anoint themselves with pious oil.
Yeah, anoint themselves with oil. So what does that mean? How? What does that equate to?
Perfume?
Yeah. Perfume. Even just hygiene, right? I mean, this is not a culture where you bathed every morning. This is like a bath was probably a several month long, like probably several times a year you would bathe. And so this, you got over that by using oils and perfumes. That's how you controlled BO, right? But oils and perfumes are expensive. And so it was only the wealthy, the notable, that could really be presentable in terms of their hygiene. What else?
They were like David.
Like David, how so?
They invented the instruments of music for themselves.
Yeah. They invented instruments. That's a really interesting one, isn't it? What's the significance of that? Why would they invent instruments?
Entertainment.
Yeah. They've got lots of time on their hands, right? I mean, there's a lot of instruments already, but they're not good enough. So, hey, we're not doing anything. Let's invent another instrument, right, to entertain us more. So entertainment was a big deal. What else?
Hey, don't grieve over the ruin of Joseph.
Yeah, we'll get there in a minute. That's an important one. They eat a lot of meat, right? We referenced that, eat baby animals. Lambs and calves. The average Jewish person in the nation of Israel this time would probably eat meat 3 times a year. So the big triannual festivals that they went to, where everybody did a big pilgrimage and they would offer these big sacrifices and everybody would eat, those would likely be the only times that if you were kind of in a peasant class in Israel, you would eat meat. The nobility, the upper class, they would have meat all the time. And so they're eating meat every day. Anything else?
Well, verse 3, they don't feel like the day of disaster is close.
Yeah.
They feel really, like, that's not good.
Yeah, they feel really safe. That's probably a reference to some type of divination they were doing, like astrology, or some type of, they're like figuring out whether they're going to be okay by casting stones or something like that. So it's probably some reference to something like that. But yeah, it makes them feel safe, makes them feel like they're, you know, nothing bad's going to happen to them. It's a good point. Okay, so if this is what they're doing, how similar is it to us? So the things that they are described on, the things that they're described by, diet, right? have an extreme diet, lots of variety, lots of recreation and entertainment. They have great hygiene. And you might kind of extrapolate that to fashion today, right? They're able to spend resources on how they look, which, you know, if you're worried about eating, you don't care about how you look. So there's a certain stability that implies, well, okay, now I can worry about how I appear to the world. They're creative. They have the leisure to be creative. So, again, think about the way we live. What's our diet like? I had meat all three meals today. Bacon, shrimp, and pork. Right? Recreation. I mean, Netflix, right? Hulu, it says it all. Entertainment. Fashion. We go shopping. We buy clothes, cars. Creative. We have energy and time to be at the top of figuring out new things and being innovative. So again, this is us, right? These people are living the way we live. They're doing the types of things we do. So the question then becomes the question that we were asked on the way back from the snow trip. If this is us and we do those things, does God think it's bad? Woe to these types of people who do these types of things. Is Amos speaking directly to us? Are these things wrong? Is it wrong to be in the upper class? Is it wrong to be powerful? Is it wrong to be wealthy? Is it wrong to eat meat, to recreate like this, to be entertained? Well, I think we have to figure out what exactly Amos is talking about. But before we do that, I want to say that these are good questions, that these are questions that we should be asking. Just like the question about the snow trip is a question we should be asking. It's not just, we shouldn't just discard these and be like, nah, I'm sure we're fine, whatever, no big deal, right? This is, the fact that we're asking this question is a good thing, to explore it. And this is the way the world looks at us and judges us. I remember when I was, several years ago, when I was in the intern class at PVC, and I think, I forget the circumstances, this is before I'd gone to seminary, but there's a potential job opening at the church, and I was kind of pseudo-interviewing for it, and one of the elders picked me up in his Mercedes SUV. And I thought, how could you be an elder at a church and drive a Mercedes SUV? Like, aren't those things just incompatible? Like, that just struck me as wrong. And so, is it? Is it wrong? Is that okay? Well, Amos asks two questions. He says two additional things about these people that I think are helpful for us to figure out what exactly is going on. The first is in the end of verse 2. He speaks to these types of people, and he asks them, are you better than these kingdoms? He's speaking of Calna and Hamath and Gath. These are lesser, mostly agricultural. These kingdoms mostly didn't have these types of people. He says, are you better than those kingdoms? Or is their territory greater than your territory? But I think the issue here that Amos is really drilling down on is a pride issue, is a superiority issue. He's speaking to a certain class of people, and he's saying, do you assume, because you're in this class, that you are better than another class? So this first issue is really one of pride for Amos that he's concerned about. He asks a second question then in verse 6. He says, he lists all the things they do, and then, I think as Felix pointed out, he lists one thing they don't do. He says, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this, but you are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. So the issue here is that you're living this way, you're eating this way and drinking this way and being entertained this way, while your brothers and sisters, your kinsmen, are suffering, are dying, are in poverty. And as we read, as we've read in the rest of the book, you're actually contributing to that. You're oppressing them, and you have no concern for them. So if this first issue has to do with pride, with a superiority, the second issue has to do with complacency. So, you know, I'm going to live the way I want to live, and it doesn't matter how anybody lives around me. I don't care that my lifestyle is radically higher than the people around me. So pride and complacency. Well, then if we're kind of tracking along with us, and how does this passage apply to us, now the question for us becomes, okay, we're like this and we do those things, but are these things true of us? Are we prideful? Are we complacent? And those are tough questions. Do I think that I'm better than people who have fewer material resources than I do? And on one level, I'll say, no, of course not, right? Everybody's equal. Like, we're all the same. But then you reflect on it and you say, do I? Do I think that I'm better because I can do things that they can't do? Because I'm educated and they're not educated? Because I have power, I'm a certain ethnicity or something? Like, do I actually somewhere think that makes me better? And that's a tough question. I think on some level the answer is probably yes. There is pride buried there. And then do I have enough sympathy for those who have fewer material resources? Am I complacent? Do I care that I live this way and others live another way? Do I care that my brothers and sisters, fellow believers that I work with in India live very different lives? Does that bother me at all? Or do I just brush it off? And again, on one level, yes, I care and I want to do something about it. And I can say, I don't know what to do and it's hard to figure out. And it is. All those things are true. But there is something inside that's just, well, you know, if I'm okay, then that's all that matters, right? There is a level of complacency there. Now, these problems then, pride and complacency, are actually connected. They have to do with the same things. They have to do with the same root issues. Pride is essentially me feeling above someone else, right? Someone else is below me. And if I feel that way, if I feel that way about someone else, it's natural not to care whether they are suffering, right? If I actually feel like I'm better because I have more resources, then I could actually convince myself that it's more just that I live better than other people, right? That could feed my complacency, because if I'm better, then I deserve it. I deserve to live the way I live. And maybe others deserve to live lesser because they're lesser than I am. And so pride and complacency feed into each other. And we get caught in this trap. And either one can start the other. So I can even say, well, you know, I don't know why I'm educated or have resources or have a good job, but maybe it's because I'm better, you know? Maybe I'm where I am because there's something better about me, and that starts to work your way into your self-image. And then that feeds, well, then it's okay that I am this way because I must be better. So we start to play these mind games, and we start to think about why does the world work the way it does, and we answer with ways that really aren't actually that helpful. So then, if these things are true, and if each of these is a way of distancing, of removing myself from other people, what's the solution? Well, notice that a lot of these things in red have to do with how I use resources, right? Money, essentially, although that's wider than that. But these things in black, they have to do with how I relate to other people. The root issues, the real problem that Amos is dealing with is not how you use your money or how you spend your resources, but it's the link between those things and the way you interact with people. Or, in these cases, the way you don't interact with people. You choose not to. The root issue is relationships. And so if that's true, then the solution is not immediately to change the way I spend my money. The solution is not to eat less meat and drink fewer songs and not invent instruments, right? The solution is to deal with the complacency. The solution is to deal with the pride. And how do we do that? We get in relationships. We build relationships with people that are different than us, with people of different classes, with people with different socioeconomic and educational and ethnic. And we expose ourselves. We find out. We interact with people. And when we do that, then we realize, I'm not better than this person. That's stupid. It's a ridiculous idea. Now, problem with that's actually harder, right? I mean, if I got up here and if I said, you know what? We need to eat less meat. That's what Amos says. So you should cut down the amount of meat you eat. You could say, wow, Paul, you're right. I'm so convicted. I need to eat less meat. And you go out that door, you could say, all right, I eat meat 7 times a week. I'm going to move down to 5. And you could feel really good about yourself, right? It's actually an easy thing to change about your life. But to walk out of here and say, we need to be interacting, we need to increase our relationships with people of different means, of different socioeconomic levels. That's a lot harder than eating less meat, than drinking fewer songs, than changing the way we spend money, right? That's a lifestyle thing. That's where do I live? That's who do I interact with? That's how do I spend my time? And honestly, it's challenging for me. I mean, I prepared this message and thinking, wow, like, how could I change this? My life is structured a certain way. My kids go to a certain school. I worship at a certain church. I'm involved in certain communities. How do you change these things? These are hard things to change. To change the way you interact with people, the types of people you interact with. But it's possible. And it's possible to do that on small scales that can grow into larger scales. This is one of the reasons why I appreciate going to India and working with pastors there and getting to know them, because it reminds me that these are my brothers and sisters and they live a different life, and it reminds me to be connected to them. I came back last time I went and I printed out pictures of all of maybe a dozen faces of pastors that I took pictures of and wrote their names and some prayer requests. They hang in my office and I look at them and remember, wow, like, these are my brothers and sisters. They're pastors in a very different environment, but they're doing the same thing I'm doing. And it draws me toward them to care about what's going on in their lives. I think one of the best examples of this actually comes from, it's kind of a random story, but it comes from the story of David and Bathsheba. One of the best examples of non-complacency. And this always challenges me. This is in 1 Samuel 11. And if you're familiar with the story, David has David is king, and David has Second Samuel 11. David has noticed a beautiful woman. He has invited her into his palace. He has slept with her. He has gotten her pregnant. So Bathsheba is now pregnant. So David says, okay, I'll cover up my mistake by inviting this woman's husband back from the battlefield, and I will invite him to my palace, and I'll give him a bunch of wine and give him a bunch of great meat, and I'll send him home and he'll sleep with his wife. And then when his wife gives birth, 8.5 months later, he'll just think it's his baby, right? This is David's grand plan. So he invites Uriah, is the name of the man. He says, come to my house. And he gets them all boozed up and gets them all eating a bunch of meat, and he sends him home, and Uriah sleeps on his doorstep. And David says, why did you do this? And Uriah says this: the ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths or tents. And my lord Joab, that's his military general, and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. That's the opposite of complacency. I don't know what the word is for that. It's not being complacent. Uriah is so concerned for his fellow soldiers, for his general, for God, the ark living in a tent, that he says, it would be wrong for me to go sleep in a bed and sleep with my wife and be comfortable. He's so connected to them that it changes the way he lives. And that can be an example for us as well. So this first part then has to do with how God's people respond to the prosperity they have. And what they have done is they have used their prosperity to distance them from other people, to become a barrier to relationships. And it is. Socioeconomics, ethnicity, education level, all those things make it harder to relate to other people. But if those are the issues, then that's how we can start moving toward a better path. God then says, because of all these things, he's going to judge his people. So this is Amos 6, verses 8 to 14. Will someone read that? 8 to 14.
The Lord God is sworn by himself, declares the Lord, the God of hosts. I abhor the pride of Jacob and hate his strongholds, and I'll deliver up the city and all that is in it. And if 10 men remain in one house, they shall die. And when one's relative, the one who anoints him for burial, shall take him up to bring the bones out of the house, and shall say to him who is in the innermost part of the house, is there still anyone with you? He shall say, no. And he shall say, silence, we must not mention the name of the Lord. For behold, the Lord commands, and the great house shall be struck down into fragments, and the little house into bits. Your horses run on rocks, does one plow there with oxen? But you have turned justice into poison, and the fruit of righteousness into wormwood. You who rejoice in Lo Debar, you say, have we not by our own strength captured Karnaim for ourselves? For behold, I will raise up against you a nation, O house of Israel, declares the Lord, the God of hosts, and they shall oppress you from Lebo Hamah to the brooks of the Arabah.
Thanks, Michael. I just didn't want to have to read all those names, so thanks for doing that. So, in the beginning, Amos lists what they're in trouble for, essentially. This is essentially listing the consequence, what's going to happen. And we're going to move a little quickly through this. We don't have time to look into all these details. But essentially, God is judging them. And the purpose of his judgment is so that they might return to him. Right? So, think about it this way. What's the purpose of physical pain, right? Our bodies, you do something, you feel pain. What's the purpose of pain?
Stop.
What?
It's like a warning.
Yeah, it's a warning. What is it warning us of?
That you shouldn't be, that's not good for you.
Right, that's not good for you. Don't do that. Exactly. So pain is designed to get you to stop doing what you're doing, right? God's judgment is the same way. They've forgotten God. They're prideful, they're complacent. So God judges them, and the purpose of that is for them to say, wow, we got to stop doing that, and essentially we have to return to God. The purpose of judgment in the scriptures is always reconciliation. The purpose is always so that people might repent and turn back to God. That's the purpose of pain, scripturally. But what happens to these people? Verse 10. Terrible things are happening, and there's this little anecdote of people in a house, and someone says, is there anyone still with you? And they say, no. And it's a little unclear what's going on, but he says, quiet. We can't mention the name of the Lord. And so what's happening is they're running away from God. They're terrified of God. They're blaming God for the judgment. And so what happens is that what is meant to remind them that they need God and push them back toward God is having the opposite effect. It's pushing them away from God. And this happens for a lot of people. I know a lot of people, I'm sure you guys do too, who maybe used to believe or used to be spiritually inclined, and then something hard happened to them or to someone they love. And they say, you know, I just can't believe in a God that would do that. I can't, life's been too hard. I can't believe in God anymore. And so pain pushes them away from God. But that's the opposite response that it's supposed to have. Pain is supposed to remind us of our deep need for God and drive us to him. And yet, it's connected to what's going on here because this is what's happening. If you are prideful and complacent, if I think so much of myself, right? And basically the root attitude here is an attitude of independence. It's a root attitude of pride. It's a root attitude of feeling like, I did it, I'm responsible, I'm competent, I deserve what I get. So this root attitude of independence, if that's true, if I'm independent, when good things happen to me, what do? Yeah, pat myself on the back. I did good. I got this great job. I can buy a great car. Man, I'm doing good, right? I feel good about myself. If I'm independent, right? And when bad things happen to me, what do?
Blame God.
I blame God, or you, or the person that cut me off, or my jerk boss, or somebody else, right? It's all about something else. Because I'm independent, it's all about me. When good things happen, it's because I'm a great guy. When bad things happen, it's because the world is against me. Right? We've heard this. Listen to your friends talk. Listen to each other talk. Listen to yourself talk sometimes. This is what we do. Right? And this is what results from that root feeling of independence. Contrast that with a biblical understanding of prosperity. If God is God, and if everything good comes from God, then when something good happens, when I get a great job or good education or whatever, then what do?
Thank God.
I thank God. I'm grateful, right? Because I realize that I am totally dependent. I am not all that. And the only reason that this good thing is happening is because God's been good to me and been gracious to me, right? I'm grateful. I praise God. My prosperity leads me to praise, not pride. And if everything comes from God, and God is God, and I'm dependent and humble, when something bad happens, what do? I ask him for help, exactly. I say, God, good and bad comes from you. For whatever reason, I'm suffering. Could you help me? Could you take it away? Could you do something different? I'm driven to God because that's my only hope. It's my only chance, is to appeal to him, to go to him, to beseech him. So pain then leads me to prayer. Prosperity leads me to praising God. It leads me to being grateful. Pain leads me to prayer. Either way, they lead me to God, right? When things are good, I'm led to God. When things are hard, I'm led to God. And yet, if my root spirit is this independent, prideful, I'm who I am because I'm who I am, good things pull me away from God and bad things pull me away from God. And that's what's happening to Israel. The prosperity God's given them has made them forget God, has made them elevate themselves above other people and not care about others. When God then brings judgment to reverse that, they curse him and they're terrified of him and they move farther away from him. And so there's this cycle. Each of those kind of feeds on the other. So the root issue then is not how we spend our money. The rooter issue is how we relate to people, but even deeper than that is how we understand who we are. And how we understand our relationship to God and the role God plays in our life. And the scriptures are clear. Everything is a spiritual issue. Everything in our lives is about how we understand God, how we relate to him. So there's these kind of three things then, right? There's this surface stuff, there's this relational stuff, and there's this spiritual stuff. Now, this is not the issue. I've said the issue is not that we eat too much meat. But all of these things are related, and each one affects the other. So as I start to feel like I'm something, right? As I start to pull away from God, I start to pull away from others, I start to spend money a little bit differently, and that makes me feel more that way about God, right? There's this cycle where each of these decisions builds on each other. And so they're all related. So because of that then, it's also true and this is why Christians have done this for centuries, millennia, is that the way we spend our money, the way we do things, also affects how we think about God. This is one of the roots of the spiritual discipline of fasting. If you stop eating for a meal or a day or 3 days, you realize really quickly how dependent you are on something outside of yourself. You realize really quickly that, wow, like, I could die if I don't eat. Like, I'm not actually self-sufficient. I need something else. That's part of what that does. So I wanted to just give a few, because so much of this has to do with finances and resources and money, I know we're going a little bit long, but I wanted to give a couple of practical suggestions then. Not that these are the issues, because the issues are deep and rooted, but how we spend our money, how we live our lives, is connected to all of that, and it comes together. So three just practical suggestions in terms of finances, and particularly in the context of how do we live in this area, in a prosperous area, in a lifestyle like we live in, and how do we do that and not just get swept away, not just make decisions without thinking and spend more and do more and never consider. So I tried to find an acronym that spelled a word. So BIG, B-I-G, all right? These are my three practical suggestions. The first is budget. And by budget, I don't even necessarily mean you don't have to start with a budget, but just starting by knowing how you spend your money is really helpful. It's really easy, I know, when you're making good money and you're single or you don't have a lot of expenses, like, you just spend, and like, that's fine. You have enough. It's not a big deal. But at least keep track of it. And there's a lot of easy ways to do that, Mint or Quicken or whatever. Just so you know, that's a starting point to say, oh, wow, I didn't realize I spend $400 a month on coffee. And at least that gives you pause to say, should I do that? And even the just make sure that your spending is intentional, that you know what you're spending, and you're making a decision, and you see, last month I spent $400 on coffee. Okay, is that okay for me to spend? And maybe you say, actually, I will hate everybody around me if I spend less than $400 on coffee. Therefore, this is, I mean, maybe you'll come to that, but at least you're thinking that through in relationship with God, in conversation with others. You're making that decision. So first thing is know what you spend, some type of budget, some type of information. Second thing then is interact with people around you. People at YAF, people in your small group, people that you live with. I think that money is the hardest thing to talk about with other people. I think it's harder to talk about money than it is to talk about sex. Talk about how much you make, how much you spend. Those types of things are incredibly personal. And there's all sorts of things about, well, I don't want to show off or don't want to feel bad, depending on which side you're on. And I don't, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that comes into play. Try to get around some of that. Find at least some people that you're able to say, maybe not all the time, but maybe, hey, you know, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? Can I talk it out with you? Am I crazy for wanting these jeans? Or, you know, whatever. I don't know what it is. But interact with other people. Allow people to come into your life and speak into it and give you feedback and say, no, this makes sense. Like, I can see your reasoning. Or, hey, that's probably not a good use of money. You know, let people challenge you. So interact. Budget is the first. Interact is the second. And the third is just generosity. Just give a lot of what you have away. Straight up, be generous. Money, time, energy, whatever it is, give a lot of it, as much as you can, away. And my kind of encouragement for generosity is, you know, sometimes people will say, well, you should give sacrificially. Give until it hurts, right? Well, that can be good advice. The problem is I don't like to hurt, right? And actually, giving can be really fun if you give to things that you're excited about. And so I'd rather say give until it feels good and find things that you're excited to give to. Find missionaries or causes or churches. I don't know, you know, like this one. Find organizations or things that you say, wow, how cool that I get to support this, that I get to help this happen. And that helps you be excited about it, because then you're giving to something that you care about. And there's ways to make giving easier. I'm sure I've mentioned before, what our policy is as families, we have kind of like a separate bank account that's kind of like our giving bank account. And every month we just automatically, there's like an automatic transfer that transfers some money into there. And then we have all of our, like, you know, we support this missionary and do this and give this much to church. And all of that comes out of that account. But we give more into it every month than goes out of it. So it grows. And then it's really cool because we've already given the money in that account. So somebody comes to YAF and says, hey, I want to go do this and it's really cool. Can you give me money? And it's like, yeah, I can. I've already given it away and now I can give it to you. It's waiting to figure out. And it's really fun then to give because it's not actually, you're not sacrificing in the moment of giving. You've already sacrificed it. And you're just waiting there to say, what cool thing is going to come up where I can give this to? So generosity is really huge. And try to be more. Try to next year give a little bit more into that account or give a little more away or try to grow. Give away what you have, money, time, energy, whatever it is. So my three practical suggestions: budget, know what you spend, interact, invite people's feedback into how you spend money, and be generous. Give a lot of it away, B-I-G. So just to wrap up with Amos then, this is a good chapter. It's a good chapter for us. It's a good chapter for us to prayerfully consider, to come to God and say, are there ways that I should spend differently? Are there ways that I should interact with people differently? Are there deep-rooted spiritual assumptions that I'm making that are at the root of a lot of this stuff? What is it that you are saying to me, God? And to go back to Dr. Jenkins' excellent question, do Christians have a moral obligation not to spend money on skiing? I think the answer is no. I think God's given us freedom. It's a good question. It's a question worth asking. I do think we have freedom, and yet it should be used cautiously, and it should be used with a spirit of humility and willingness to say, maybe this year I have that freedom, maybe next year God's asking me something different. Kind of a constant rechecking of, what are you doing, God? What is the community I live in? What lifestyle are you calling me to? How are you asking me to live? And really being willing to revisit that.